in the first book of Peter. And you don't have to turn there if you don't want to, but Peter, the apostle, who we read about in the chapter we've just been reading today, how he was called by Jesus to follow him, wrote a letter to various people. And at the end of that letter, in chapter 5 and verse 13, he talks about Mark. He talks about the person who wrote this gospel. And he describes him like this. He says, he's my son. He says, my son Mark. Now, that doesn't mean that, biologically speaking, he's saying that I am his natural father. He's describing a particular relationship that exists between him and Mark. A very close relationship, very intimate relationship, like a father to a son. And that letter was written about 30 years after Jesus was crucified. About 30 years after Jesus was crucified. And we know that this relationship, this closeness that grew up between the two of them, could be traced back some considerable years. In Acts chapter 12, if you're familiar with it, there's an account there of a prayer meeting that took place in Jerusalem at a house of a woman called Mary. And Mary's son was called Mark, John Mark, this person who wrote this gospel. And Peter came to that prayer meeting, and everybody was very surprised because they thought he was in prison. And they were actually praying specifically that he could be set free. And lo and behold, he turned up at the prayer meeting, which is pretty good. That is the first record we have of these two men, Mark and Peter, being in the same room together. Now, they may have known each other before that, but we certainly know that they've known each other for that period. And when we trace that back, that prayer meeting took place about 20-something years before he calls Mark my son. So what I'm describing to you is a relationship that over a period of time develops and matures into something that I would call a discipleship relationship. Where somebody who perhaps initially you haven't got a necessarily strong bond, you may know socially, you may be friends with, but over a period of time, spiritually speaking, that person is taken under your wing, and over a period of time, you grow in concern and interest in that person's soul in such a way that you invest spiritually whatever riches you have, whatever you know of Christ, whatever spiritual riches you have, you invest that into that person. And that person ends up, you come to a place where you can say, it's like my son in the Lord. You know, the point of sonship in this terms is that when you die, when you're gone, when you're not here, the son is the one that you give your most treasured things to. The person who inherits what is most valuable to you. The person who you pass on the good things so that they can live their life as fully as you've enjoyed living yourself. And that's what he's been doing for years and years and years. He's been developing a relationship with Mark so that he can take those precious things that he's enjoyed and enjoy them long after Peter is gone. That's what we're seeing taking place here. We know that the Gospel of Mark, as he was saying last time, was probably finalized before Peter actually died. And you can see that by the time Peter had gone, Mark had got it, hadn't he? Mark had got a hold of what Peter had been wanting to teach him. And so when Peter was martyred and killed and murdered, brutally murdered in Rome in about 67 AD, Mark had the Gospel. And in that sense, it's not the Gospel of Peter, although of course he is the great influence in Mark's life. It is truly Mark's Gospel because Peter has given it to him. And I think when you get somebody who's been discipled by you, or somebody's been discipled, they have got, it's theirs now. It belongs to them. They take ownership of it and have liberty and freedom with the gifts that you've imparted to them. I love meeting great people. Fiona Williams is not here today. I love talking to her dad. He used to fly a Spitfire. And not only did he fly Spitfires, which is pretty cool in its own right, during the war and all that sort of thing, he actually crashed a Spitfire in the desert in Libya and was thrown clear of the cockpit and the whole thing exploded. I mean, yes, what a great story to sit down. I can listen to it for ages. And, you know, these kind of guys are amazing, aren't they? Peter walked on water. Peter walked on water. You meet a man who's walked on water with Jesus, I would like to spend some time with him. And Mark had that opportunity. And Peter's spirit and character and nature invited and allowed somebody who wanted to spend time, wanted to learn from his experience, to come close enough to learn and to be entrusted with the things that he's experienced over not just, you know, one session, but over years, this relationship developed. Like the trellis and the vine. You know, when you put a trellis up, it's one person, it's like a person just stands still and lets somebody just grow up around them. They remain constant and steady while other people can just find their way in to a fruitful place. And that's what the Bible teaches us to do, to invest the good things that we have into faithful people who will look after them and treasure them and use them well and so on and so forth. Discipleship. And we find out how to use our gifts, don't we, when we're being discipled. You know, the idea that a discipleship thing is a totally exclusive relationship. It's just Peter and Mark and nobody else is allowed in there. That's not how it is. Mark spent considerable time with the Apostle Paul as well. That's got to have been a helpful experience, hasn't it? Spending time with the Apostle Paul. But one of the things he learned spending time with Paul is that Mark was definitely not a missionary. He discovered, Paul made it very clear to him, you're not cut out for this. This is not your gifting. And Paul never calls Mark my son. He was discipling people like Timothy, wasn't he? He calls Timothy my son. He was a missionary pastor. This is a man after my own heart. This is somebody I'm developing. And one of the things that he discovers as he spends time with Paul and others who are also discipling him in different ways is his gifts. He's an evangelist. That's his gift. That's what God equips him to do. It's to tell the good news of Jesus just like Peter had been doing. So we help to find our gifts in those discipleship relationships. So going back to one-to-one, this is going back to the video that we saw before, reading the Bible together with people. We're hoping to publish it very soon, a list. And on that list will be your names. And if your name isn't on there, you can come to us and we'll get your name on that list. And on that list, we're going to pair you up with somebody. And it may not be your best friend, but it may be somebody who's in the fellowship, somebody with whom once a month, instead of meeting on a Tuesday night for our house group, you can sit down for an hour and spend time reading John's Gospel, reading about Jesus with another person, and hopefully beginning to develop a discipleship relationship and just working that out. And if you're so inclined and so gifted, ask somebody who perhaps doesn't know Jesus yet, because most of the people who we're going to be pairing you up with already know the Lord. But there may be other people that you've been longing to think, how can I just spend a bit of time just sharing my faith in a simple, non-confrontational sort of way, giving them an opportunity to know what I know, to know this person Jesus, have read the Gospels, and maybe you can spend time with somebody just once a month or something, building up that kind of a relationship with them. That's partly what we're doing. You know, Mark discovered he was an evangelist. I don't think everybody in this room is an evangelist. I've got a funny feeling there's definitely one evangelist in this room, and there may be others. I know there are other people who are very evangelistically minded and concerned about other people's souls. And again, the DVDs that we're going to do in the house group. This is a bit of an advert bit. You get that, haven't you? You worked that out. The DVDs in the house groups, that is there because we want to develop our evangelistic gifts. If we're going to do outreach, if we're going to be involved in Passion for Life, it doesn't mean you're going to end up as an evangelist, but at least such skills and abilities as we have and concerns we have, we can do them as best we can. So if we get a DVD from somebody who's a skilled and equipped evangelist, what a good idea to sit and listen to what they have to say. Maybe it'll help us to do what we want to do better. So those things are all coming up. Mark found out in the relationship as a disciple that he was an evangelist. That's what he was cut out to do, and he set out to do it. And it made him so helpful, so effective. You see, if you're discipled, if you'll be discipled, it will actually make you more effective as a Christian. If you want to be more effective as a Christian, discipleship is definitely for you. So he's not just sitting in an exclusive relationship with Peter. He goes out with people like Paul. And in 2 Timothy, as he's writing to the person Paul is discipling, he says of Mark, he says, he is extremely useful to my ministry. Because he's been discipled. Because he's got something to give. So other people can benefit from those gifts. And it wasn't just Paul who is benefiting. You said last week, 350 verses out of Luke's gospel were written by Mark. He was so greatly helped in his discipleship that he was able to assist in the production of the second great gospel, the Gospel of Luke. And it doesn't finish there. The Gospel of Matthew. Huge numbers of verses in the Gospel of Matthew were written by Mark. So the fruits of sitting under somebody's ministry and benefiting from their ministry started to flow out into Luke, into Matthew. What a blessing. What a gift. And it helped Paul too. So we can see the fruits of discipleship growing out there. Now all the different gospels are different, aren't they? They're all different. They've all got their own voices, they've got their own contributions to make, and they're all organized in their own different ways. If you're the sort of person who wants to know, well, what happened first and what happened afterwards and then what happened and then what happened, read Luke. Luke will write an orderly account for you. He'll put it all down like that. And if you want to know about how Jesus' life and ministry is really a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy and the Levitical laws and so on and so forth, read Matthew, because he's an expert. He can contribute that to you, most certainly. But if you want to be a disciple, if you want to be discipled, if you want to remember what Jesus has done, and you want to take it away with you, spend some time in Mark's gospel. Spend some time in Mark's gospel. Maybe, you know, on our website, we've got learnscripture.net. And there's a memorization tool up there that can help you commit the scriptures to your memory. Why not set about learning, like some people in this room have already begun, parts of Mark's gospel? Commit it to heart. So when you're out there, on the road, driving your car, in the office, with the family, doing what you've got it. You've got it. We can't always open the book. But if you've committed to your heart, you commit it to your memory, it's yours, isn't it? And Mark's gospel is the most memorable. It just rushes forth, and I'm going to show you, to some extent, the structure of the book to help you to see how you can set about learning Mark's gospel. And it'd be a good thing to do. It's a challenge for us in 2014. It's interesting. It's interesting that Mark's gospel is the most memorable one. It's the one that comes under Peter's influence. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not a deep sea fisherman. But I know that if I was going to become one, I probably would not find a university course offering to train and teach me to become a deep sea fisherman. I would probably have to go down to Grimsby or something like that, and I'd have to go and find a boat, and I'd probably have to persuade somebody to let me get on board. And what would probably happen in my time on board is that they wouldn't trust me with anything to start with, and I'd be swabbing the decks, right? And being sick, probably, a lot of the time. But over time, if I turned up every morning on the quay and got on that boat, those fishermen would end up just saying, well, you can fix the nets now, and bit by bit, oh, take the wheel for a minute. And over time, I'd be taught by experience. And by the end of it, one day, I'd be able to get on a boat and drive it out to the sea. I'd know where the fish were. I'd be able to put down the nets, tell somebody else what to do, and we'd come home with a catch of fish. That's how you'd learn. And that's the kind of man Peter is. He's a man who wants to learn you to learn by experience. He wants to imbibe you into the Mark experience, to train you up. Now, we talked about one-to-one, but it's also what we're doing here, isn't it? I hope you don't come here to church to be told about Jesus. Okay, maybe that's part of what we do. I hope that what you do when you come here to church is you get to know him. That you deepen your experience of Jesus and your knowledge and your experience of Jesus. That actually you get to know him better and better. That you don't come to church to meet Jesus. That you bring your relationship with Jesus here, and you take it away enriched, and it's growing all the time. You're with Jesus all the time, and he is with you all the time. That you're a disciple of the Lord Jesus, and the Lord has used this service as a way of helping and encouraging you that. I mean, why do you come to church? Why do we come to church? Do you come for the good music? The music's good. Do you come for the good music? Do you come for the good preaching, like when Phil's preaching? Do you come for that? Okay? Do you come for the good coffee? The coffee's great now, right? I hope you don't come for those things. Not even the preaching. You come for Jesus, don't you? We're here for Jesus. We want to grow and learn in him. And all these things have to, the only reason these things are here is to help you, to strengthen you, to like trellis and vine, as part of our discipleship. We do it as a group, we do it individually. Being discipled, that's what it's all about, growing in our relationship with Jesus. But through the people that the Lord has sent before us, who've got some experience and can pass these things on to us gradually over time. That's how, why we need to make a commitment. 2014, beginning of the year, commitment. It's always worth talking about, isn't it? Because as you invest into it and you're invested into, you may not even realize it over time. But I watch people, as a pastor, I watch people. I see them grow. I see the little green shoots coming out. I rejoice when I see that little tendril springing out. And I see, oh, that person wasn't doing that then. It's such a joy. It's part of the joy of the work that I do. It's interesting, this gospel of Mark. He is, you know, this is also important too about Mark. When you read Mark, and I hope you're going to spend some time reading Mark over the next few weeks and months even, you'll find somebody who doesn't assume that you know anything. All right? He takes you where you're at. He doesn't assume you know about Aramaic or the finer details of the Jewish religion or the Old Testament or anything like that. If there's something he needs, if he uses a technical word, he'll even explain it to you. It's such an accessible book, so helpful. And it's interesting as well that he wrote it in the language that he wrote it. He probably spoke Aramaic, which was a localized language from the people that he grew up amongst, a tribal language, if you want to call it like that. And people all around the Roman world spoke their own tribal languages. And he could have written it in that language for his people, and they'd have been able to read it, and they'd have been able to appreciate it. He could have written the whole gospel in Latin, which is what the oi polloi, the rich, the mighty, the powerful, the Caesars, the governors, the rulers, the rulers of the court. You know, let's write a gospel to try and get the top-notch people involved. If they're Christians, then all the rest of us will have. He doesn't do that. He writes it in Greek. At the time when he wrote that, that was the language that all the ordinary people, everybody spoke at least some Greek. This was the language for everybody. This is a gospel for everyone. Taking anybody where you're at and beginning a journey of discipleship with you, leading you step by step into the experience that he's had of walking with the Lord Jesus himself and getting to know him personally. That's the challenge that Mark's gospel presents to us. And you really do need to know what he's got to teach. You really, really do need. Because like his day and ours, there are so many voices in this world that want you to believe so many different things. And it would be like it's like a pearl of great price. You cannot assume that somebody's just going to come to know Jesus just as it happens. It doesn't happen like that. Look around the world, all the different persuasions and beliefs that people have around the world. There is no God, or God is, this is his prophet, or there's so much confusion. We need to hear a voice speaking to us consistently, telling us the truth. This man Jesus, you need to know this man Jesus. Why? Because as it said, chapter 1, verse 1, this man is the Son of God. This is the Son of God. This is Christ, nobody else. It's him. And you need to know that. You need to know that. And what a helpful thing it is that he's written this book so that people all around the world, ordinary people all around the world, should hear it and know it. Who rules your life? Who's the most important person in your life? Who are you most concerned about? Your boss? Your husband? Your wife? David Cameron? Barack Obama? Who's in charge? Who's the most important person? Who should you know? Who would you most think is most important to know? Be on the right side of? Whose commandments do you think you should most likely obey for the happiness and welfare of your soul? Who's the most important person in the world? Mark will tell you, straight and clear, it's Jesus Christ. It's Jesus Christ. There is just nobody more important than Jesus. There's nobody you need to know more than this person, Jesus. He's the Christ. He is the Son of God. And that's good news. That's good news, as we're going to see in a minute. I mean, let me give you an illustration. going back to Peter for a minute. You know he walked on water, we mentioned that already. You may be incredulous about that. You may think, well, just like maybe when you listen to an old soldier and they start telling their war stories, you might think to yourself, well, I wasn't there, I wasn't a witness and all that. But what's amazing when you listen to the old soldiers is how all their stories have the same character, don't they? It's incredible the things that generation got up to, the sort of things they just did in their ordinary days. Isaac and I were listening to Jeremy Clarkson talking about the Atlantic convoys and some of the things they got up with. Unbelievable. And they're all so quiet and modest about it all. But when they get talking, they tell you these incredible stories. Peter walked on water. Peter walked on water. And remember what happened as he was walking on water. He's walking out there on the water. Just like you and I, we walk out in faith in our lives. And as he kept his eyes firmly fixed on Jesus and did what he said, what happened? He walked on the water, didn't he? He just carried on walking. And the moment he looked around and heard all the other voices, the waves, I won't keep you up. This is water. You're too heavy. You're going to sink. You're a fisherman. You know about this. I'm going to take you down and I'm going to drown you at the bottom of this lake and you're never going to see the light of day again. And the wind shouting out and saying that you've got no future, mate. I'm going to blow you down. You've got no future. I'm going to whip these waves up and you are finished. You've got no future. You're doing something crazy. You're believing something ridiculous. When he saw those things, he sank, didn't he? When unbelief entered his heart, he sank. But when he looked at Jesus, he just carried on walking. He carried on walking. So we need to remember, don't we, when we're out and about and going about our business, who is really in charge in this world? Who really has the final word? Who do we need to follow? Who do we need to obey? Who do we need to concentrate on? And who do we need to remember more than anybody else? It's Jesus. If we keep our eyes on him, says in Hebrews, he's the author and the finisher of our faith. Looking unto Jesus. That's what we've got to do, isn't it? And taking that knowledge with us is the way to do that. Now, verse 1, it says, Jesus, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Jesus, the Son of God. And that's the most important thing he wants us to know about. That's what he's going to be explaining and teaching to us all through his gospel. And he splits up his gospel into six sections. This is the teaching part. This is the teaching part. There are six sections to this gospel. How many are there? Is anybody still awake? Six. Okay. We've got six sections. And in each of those sections, you have one introduction, followed by eight illustrations, followed by a conclusion. All right? An introduction, eight illustrations, a conclusion. How many times? Six. So there's six sections. Each of those sections has an introduction, eight illustrations, a conclusion. Can you learn that? You got it? 1, 8, 1 times 6. You got it? Broadly speaking. It's little packages. It's little packages. The whole gospel is set up in little packages like this. At the moment, we're looking at the first package, which starts in chapter 1, verse 1, with the introduction, obviously, which Andy was dealing with last week. The first 20 verses is the introduction. From that point onwards, what we read today, did you notice what we were reading today? It was one story after another, wasn't it? Jesus did this, and then Jesus did that. Eight stories, eight illustrations, eight demonstrations of what he said. What did he say at the beginning? Jesus is the Son of God. And what are the eight illustrations are? Look at him at work. How do I know he's the Son of God? He heals the sick. He casts out demons. Giving illustrations, proofs, so that you can remember. He's the Son of God, and he heals the sick. He casts out demons. He speaks with authority. You've got illustrations. Very simple, even if you can't remember all the words. You've got the basic structure, haven't you? You can remember the things that Jesus does. And that's how the gospel works. Because the thing that this first section really wants to get across about to us is this, that Jesus is God's son, and yes, he faces opposition. Did you notice in those last four illustrations, everybody's criticizing Jesus? People oppose him, but he doesn't give up, and he keeps reaching out. And this is the important thing for us. He keeps reaching out to ordinary people like you and me. He keeps loving ordinary people. He keeps caring for people who are in trouble and in difficulty, who are struggling. That's the Son of God. He's a merciful God. And he reaches down to ordinary people, he touches their lives, and he changes their lives in the most remarkable way. That's the real thing that he's getting across, the first thing that he's really getting across at the beginning of his gospel. Because that's his experience, that's what he learned, and that's what Peter learned as well. And the whole way the structure, the beginning of Mark's gospel, the first introduction is put together, and Andy was treating that last week, I'll just deal with it very, very quickly, is that he says, this isn't just my own opinion. If it was just my own opinion, perhaps you could dismiss it. But then he goes straight in, doesn't he, in the first couple of verses to show you how the prophets, in other words, the Israelites have been saying this about the Savior of the world for hundreds of years. It's nothing new. People have always believed that the Savior would come and that he'd be like he is. And then when John the Baptist turned up on the scene, a prophet at work in their own days, verses 4 and 8, as soon as Jesus appears before John the Baptist, he knew that this Jesus was the Son of God, the Christ, and rejoiced in him. So people have been saying it for years, and then when John saw him, he could tell that this man was the man. And it wasn't just that, as we heard last week. The heavens themselves opened. God testified that this Jesus is the Christ, God's Son. The Holy Spirit came down from heaven to testify that this is God's Son, the Christ. So the prophets are saying it. The prophets in their day are saying it. The Israelites and the faithful of old have been saying it. John the Baptist saying, God's saying it. And then straight into the wilderness he goes in verse 21. And out there in the wilderness, verse 12. And who does he discover out there? The devil. The devil knows who Jesus is. Let me tell you, the devil knows who Jesus is. He knows he's the Christ. He knows he's the Son of God. And then the angels, when he's hungry and thirsty, who do they go and minister to? To Jesus. Because they recognize their Lord. So they go and minister to him because he's the Christ. Because he's the Son of God. And it doesn't just stop there, does it? He talks about it himself in verses 14 to 16. Jesus himself testifies that he's the Son of God. The kingdom of God is near. It's here. It's now. It's me. The King is here. Everybody's saying the same thing. And these people they were speaking to at that time knew from long ago that there were no powers that could not be overcome by their God. The Egyptians had been swept aside in a day. The Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Greeks. The Romans were there and they would go. Only one kingdom lasts. Only one king remains. And Jesus is Lord. Jesus is Christ. He's the one you've got to stay faithful to. He's the one you've got to believe. Jesus himself, when he came to submit himself to baptism, saying, I agree, this is true. And as he goes around the lake and he meets ordinary people like Peter, it's quite sweet, isn't it? Verse 16, if you look in verse 16, the first person mentioned here, he doesn't give a credit to his gospel. It does not call Peter's gospel written by Mark. It's Mark's gospel, but he recognizes, verse 16, the first person called by Jesus to follow him was Peter. The man who has become my disciple, the one who's given me so much. He was the one from the beginning, and he shared all these things with me. And people, ordinary people, recognized when Jesus called them, when they heard that voice, Jesus' voice in their life, and he said, follow me, they left everything, didn't they? Why? They recognized there's something about it. He's the one. He's the one. So the whole point about the introduction is just to confirm and reaffirm over and over again who this person Jesus is, God's Son. God's Son. So look, very briefly, we're going to look at these illustrations then. Okay? So we've got the introduction, Jesus is God's Son. Everybody's saying it. Anybody who matters is saying that Jesus is the Christ. And let's look at the proof. The first one, verse 21 through to 28. Evil spirits. I was at a dinner last night, and the donations were going to a charity that favours people who are suffering combat stress. You know, my uncle was in the military, and he came through in pretty good shape, but he recognised lots of people don't. Lots of people don't. Psychologically, it can be devastating. So there's a charity that helps people like that. And this is the phrase he used. You know, some people, they come back from combat, and they wrestle with their demons for years. You know? The devil gets in and oppresses people. Jesus turns up, it's gone. Jesus turns up and it's gone. You know, it's not years of therapy, though that is good, commendable. But when Jesus is present, when those evil spirits cannot remain where Jesus is. So who is this man? What kind of a man has that influence that evil spirits just leave at his word? And then he moves on to the second illustration, verse 29. I hate being ill. Sean will tell you, I'm not a very good patient. I get man flu. When I get man flu. When I go down, I'm awful, right? I don't know what you like, but I hate being sick. Does anybody here like being sick? Right? I have to say, in fairness, again, one of my cousins, she's had a long-term illness right from her birth, and she's carried it, and she's in constant pain. She's in her early 30s now, and you'd never know she was in as much pain as she is. Some people carry their sicknesses with remarkable dignity so that, you know, it seemingly doesn't affect her psychologically or whatever like that. But sickness is bad. Sickness is bad. When Jesus turns up, his power is broken off people's lives. Here's this person, this woman, she's sick. He enters the room, touches her hand, he's well, she's well. People bring their sick to her, to the door. They all come around the door with their sick and they're demon-possessed. And sickness is power. You know what it's like? That's the awful thing about it. There's nothing you can do about it. That's the worst thing you can hear, isn't it, from a doctor? There is nothing we can do. Jesus turns up. It doesn't say what was the problems, but whatever it is, the present. Who is this man? Who is this man that sickness cannot remain in his presence? Evil spirits can't remain in his presence. And then in verse 35 onwards, the third. So we've got these three, third illustration, verse 35. And he's going around teaching, isn't he, in this? He goes out praying in this solitary prayer, going around teaching people. And everybody's looking for him. And everybody wants to learn from him because his teaching is so extraordinary, isn't it? You know, there's so much ignorance about. There's so much foolishness. People say so many stupid things. You listen to Jesus. He never puts a foot wrong, does he? He never says something stupid. He never says something ignorant. Everything he says is just wise and insightful and powerful and important. And what a blessing to know somebody. Who is this man that never says anything other than something you want to treasure for the rest of your life? Who is this man? He's the Son of God. It's the Christ. And then the fourth illustration is leprosy, the example of leprosy. We have the C word today, don't we? Cancer. The thing that nobody can quite crack. It terrorizes our lives. Is this me? Has this happened to me? Leprosy was the cancer of the ancient world. It was irreversible, irrevocable. You went into a dreadful, long, protracted, isolated, miserable death. Jesus turns up, and a man separated from the whole of his community by his illness and disease, Jesus turns up. A man's made clean and goes off to worship, goes off to chapel the following morning to say his prayers and give thanks to God. Who is this man? Who is this man? Is this just a mere man? Is this just a politician, a great politician, or a great teacher? Who can do such things? A magician? Simon Arnold's very good yesterday. We had a really good time here. Dads and lads here yesterday. Really good. How many people were here? I'm rubbish with numbers. 20, 30? 40? It's great. Really encouraging. Simon did a couple of magic tricks. This is not magic. This is not magic. This is the Son of God. This is the Son of God. And the next four illustrations, this is the last little bit. The next four illustrations. So how many sections are there? Quickly, let me just check you. Six sections in the book, right? The whole gospel, six sections, right? Each section has got an introduction, eight illustrations, right? And a conclusion, yes? And that's not working. There we go. Don't worry about that right now. We got that? So we've had four illustrations. Four more. All right? Can you tell me what the first four illustrations are, very quickly? Do you know what they are? What's he done? What does Jesus do? He heals the sick, casts out evil spirits, taught with wisdom, even overcame leprosy. All right? Okay? Four simple things. All right? Now, the next four illustrations are slightly different, because they've got a slightly different character, a different tone to them. But get a hold of it, because it's important. Have you noticed not everybody believes in Jesus? Have you noticed that not everybody says the same things about Jesus as the sort of things that Mark is saying and everybody else? Have you noticed some people really don't like Jesus? They're quite hostile. Have you noticed? There's nothing new. And these four illustrations show that though Jesus is the Son of God and he reaches out to ordinary people and cares for them, people actually are very hostile to him as well. Verse 1 of chapter 2. He goes out forgiving sin. What a beautiful thing to do. What a beautiful thing to do. For somebody who's sinned, they're dead in their sins, and he forgives them. Isn't that the most beautiful thing to do? But they criticize him. They just criticize him for forgiving sin. And then in verse 13, you go down a little bit further. He talks about the sick need a doctor. He goes out amongst people who are far from God, sinners, tax collectors, confused, out there in the world, dead in their sins and transgressions, lost souls. He doesn't just walk by on the other side. That wouldn't be the right thing to do, would it? He goes to them, he goes and sits at their tables, he goes and talks to them and meets them and helps them and heals them and teaches them and loves them. And you just criticize him. What are you doing with that lot? Just gets criticized. And then in verse 18, he's very clear in verse 18 there onwards down to verse 22 that he gets criticized for forgiving sin, he gets criticized for eating with sinners, and it's pretty clear as he talks about the wineskins that it's not going to be possible for the old religious order and the new thing that God is doing to work hand in hand together. The hostility is such that they're going to go their separate ways. They're going to put new wine in new wineskins because there's so many people who are stuck in their ways, obstinate, digging their heels in, and they're going to stay in their traditions even if the Son of God turns up in power. And the two are incompatible. And that's just the way it is. And then the third illustration, verse 23 to 38. He goes out walking in the fields, picking on the Sabbath, and feeding his disciples. And they're all fine, and it's perfectly with. I could read you the chapter in the book of Leviticus that justifies his actions as being perfectly acceptable. And he justifies it from the scriptures and so on. But they still criticize him. Some people, you just can't do right. You just can't do right. Because they have got a problem. They have got a problem. And not believing in Jesus is actually a sign of having a bit of a problem. So, four illustrations there. Four secondary illustrations. Criticized for forgiving sin. Criticized for eating with sinners. Criticized so much that his movement was being driven out from the mainstream rather than welcomed in, and criticized for his attitudes to the Sabbath. So this is where all these things leave us in conclusion. So Jesus is God's son, says Mark. I love the way he doesn't say, I believe he's his son. He doesn't say, some Christians believe that Jesus is his son. He just says, Jesus is the Son of God. And he leaves and he follows these eight illustrations to demonstrate and prove what he's just said. And then we're left with a question. What do you believe? What do you believe? Who do you believe he is? What do you believe? Which side of the line do you come down on? What do you think? What do you believe? That's where he leaves it, isn't it? He gives us this challenge. Who do you believe in? The angels, the apostles, God himself. All these people believe that Jesus is God. What about you? What about you? How do we know that he healed the sick? He cast out evil spirits. He taught with wisdom and power. You can put it down into one sentence. He cleansed the unclean. Jesus is the Son of God. And why do people not believe in him? Why do they reject him still? Because they're jealous of his authority. Because they like being in charge and are unwilling to be a disciple and submit. Because they're offended at the fact that he's not impressed with their good works. Because to be honest with you, from his perspective, we're all sinners. Who's like him? Nobody. And some people, they just, if I'm not in charge and I'm not leading, I'm not going to submit and follow anybody. Even if God himself came in the flesh, I'm going to do my own thing. It's called pride. It's called pride. People hated the fact that he was not in submission to anybody. Because Jesus is Lord. He's Lord. And we must submit to him. Now, after the service today, we're going to